Mull. This visit now culminating in this meeting with all the Scottish friends whom I see have come from far and wide, and some have come from England as well. So welcome to all of you. I'm sure we are all eager and awaiting to hear Ruhia Khanum's address to us.
Can you record from there? Shankar will pick it up. Because that gadget that she has is not our doing. It's for the National Assembly, who thrust it on Mrs. Napchavani just before we started this trip and said, will you please record these talks for us? And she's had to take it all around with her. I suggest, Bilal, you come up here. Why don't you come up? Life was remarkably peaceful, you know, before we had all these gadgets. When I was a girl, well, I admit we had the telephone and electricity, but we didn't have tape recorders and moving picture cameras and all kinds of modern improvements. So in many ways, we lived much more peacefully. We didn't live such a tempestuous existence as we do now with all of these things. I am very, very happy to be here in Edinburgh, and this is my third visit here. I came here with the beloved guardian, Shoghi Effendi, many, many years ago, right after the war. And then we came back a second time, and he said, I'm going to take you to the home of your ancestors, which part of my family came from Aberdeen. So Aberdeen was the home, so to speak, of my ancestors in one part of Scotland. And Jedburgh, on the border, was the home of my father's people, the Maxwells. And on my father's other side, through his mother, he was a McBean and a Sutherland. Probably, of course, must be a lot more other clans involved because they were so intermarried. But I've always felt, for some reason that I don't really know, a tremendous kinship for the Scottish people. I've always considered myself, since I knew what a Scot was, that I was a Scot, although the other half of me is English-American background. But I never feel any raging affinity for that part of it, but I always feel very strongly Scottish, and I don't know why. I don't think I took it in, what Scotland was or the Scotch were, until I was about 8 years old when the Armistice Parade took place in Montreal. And I and my cousins all went to the home of an aunt who had a very good view of the parade, which took place on the main street and was very impressive and very long. After all, it was the Armistice Parade in Montreal. And we could overlook it from the windows of her apartment. And for the first time that I recollect having any exposure to it, so to speak, I heard the bagpipes. And I remember still, I was quite small, of course, and this thing just went through me like fire, you see. And I began to get uneasy, and I couldn't understand what was happening to me. And my father looked at me. He said, it's because you're a Scot. And you know, I think that's true. I don't know. I suppose it's true of all of us. There's something about the bagpipes that makes our blood tingle, and it goes right straight through us. And I can't truthfully say that it went through Shoghi Effendi, the head of the Baha'i faith, but he didn't particularly object to the bagpipes, let's put it that way. And he knew that I liked them very much. So when we came up here to Scotland, the two different trips that we made, I've been trying to recollect exactly where we went. The first time we came up by train, and the second time we had a car at our disposal, and that made it easier to get around. We went, let's see, we've been to Loch Lomond, Gleneagles, Stirling, Edinburgh, Glasgow. We went over once to Glasgow together and to Aberdeen. And of course, we might have stopped at some small places motoring from Edinburgh to Aberdeen, but I don't recollect at this point what their names were. I can remember one incident. I think it must have been at Glen Eagles. I can't think where else it would have been. And after dinner, in the foyer of the hotel, people were dancing Scottish reels in the kilts. And Shoghi Effendi thought it was beautiful. He thought it was lovely music and very, very graceful dancing. And I can remember now how much he enjoyed that. And I'm so sorry that on this occasion in Scotland, when I've come here after so many years, I haven't either heard the bagpipes once, although I heard the flute, that was the nearest I got, and I appreciated it. And I haven't been able to see any Scottish reels, but perhaps another time, who knows. You know, it's so strange, our relationship mentally to our ancestors. Of course, we all have them, obviously, we wouldn't be here. But if you think of it, one generation back you have two, your grandparents are already four, your great-grandparents are eight, your great-great-grandparents are 16, so that when my father's family started coming out from Scotland, I must have had 32 ancestors, and just before that, 64. But all of us like to go back to one particular person. And I have the hope of writing a biography called The Maxwells. And it has an interesting history, because once when I was, I don't know, about 17 or 18 years old, I looked at my mother. We were in a hotel in New York, and I said, "You know, Mother, when you die, I'm going to write your biography." And she looked very happy. And she said, "Will you?" "Oh," I said, "yes, I will." Well, I'm now 71 and I haven't done it, you see, and it's worrying me, because I don't want to die without fulfilling what I consider was tantamount to an assurance, a promise to my mother that I would do this. And now I've been thinking about it all these years and never had a chance. And of course, as you know, she was a very early Baha'i and a very historic figure, like all of those early Baha'is of her generation. And then I thought, well, I can't write about my mother and leave my father out of it. What will I do with him? She married him. Then I thought, well, what am I going to do with me, you see? I can't leave me out of it, because there were the three of us, my mother and my father and me, in a very close family. And then how far to take it? She died in 1940, but my father didn't die till 1952. And by that time, of course, I had been married many years to the head of the Baha'i faith. So how could I leave Shoghi Effendi out of it? And then where do I cut it off, you see? The whole thing is very involved, but I hope very, very much that I'm going to be able to write this book, and that's one of the main things I'm trying to get home to Haifa for, is to begin on this biography. And I've been trying to collect materials, and I've been reading up things with my Maxwell cousins in Canada and my Bowles cousins in the United States. And I was thinking the other day, there's a Bowles that is supposedly an ancestor who came over with William the Conqueror, and he was a long bowman. Well, I'm very weak at mathematics, but try and figure out, somebody who's clever at it, how many ancestors I had in 1066. When one that I think of that might have been related to me was a long bowman, you see. But I must have had thousands of ancestors. But this is the way our minds work, you see. We think that this particular famous person, this particular prominent person, this particular person who was distinguished, was our ancestor. And we forget the other 500 or 5,000 as if they didn't exist. So that all this business of ancestry really is a rather shaky thing and a rather silly thing if you analyze it. But then, of course, we all enjoy it very much. I am in the nature of a package. I have come to the conclusion that mentally the best way to describe myself to myself is that I am a package that is handed on from one Baha'i committee to another, one Baha'i driver to another, one Baha'i chairman to another, and sometimes I'm delayed in transit. And when I'm delayed in transit, I must not be held to account, because usually I know where I am when I start, but I don't even know where I'm going. So if I was a little late, you must excuse the transit operation. But it's wonderful to be here with the Baha'is, and a very, very happy occasion for me. I was so anxious all these years, in the back of my mind, to go and visit these outer islands in the north. And from the very beginning of the World Crusade and the early days when the British Baha'is were encouraged by the Guardian to turn their thoughts to these islands that were so isolated and go and carry the message of Baha'u'llah to them, I, of course, have followed their development. And Charles Dunning, as you know, came to Haifa as a pilgrim in the days of Shoghi Effendi, the Knight of Baha'u'llah, for the Orkneys, and Shoghi Effendi was so happy to have him and made such a fuss over him. And other Baha'is have come from these islands, both before the passing and after the passing of the Guardian. And they're always something very special because they come from so far away. And I think that until this trip, I had the impression that they were sort of heroic unfortunates. They were way off the other end of nowhere, you know, holding the fort, looking into the spray of the North Sea, living difficult existences, and to be both admired and pitied. But since this trip, I don't pity them, I admire them, but I envy them. And I can't tell you how much I would like to live under the circumstances that they do, where the tempo of life is quieter, where the people are still more moral, more God-fearing, more honest, more courteous, where you have the hope of your children growing up and going, first of all, breathing good air, which I think we underestimate. I don't think we realize that whatever you eat is important, but what you breathe is just as important, perhaps even in some ways more important for your health. And of course we, most of the people perhaps from cities like myself, are breathing concentrated petrol fumes, and they're very bad for us. In other words, we're increasingly getting lead poisoning and a few other things. But the point is that far from being envied, being pitied, these people living in these islands, I think, in many ways, should be envied because they are living close to nature. Now, of course, farmers and people living outside the big cities all over these British Isles are also in much healthier circumstances than the people living in the cities. But the further away you are from it, the better off you often are in the moral climate that you are living in. I know that these people in the islands, some of them particularly, are extremely orthodox Christians, if you want to put it that way. Perhaps in their own way, fanatical Christians. And that there is a feeling of at least resistance, if not prejudice, against foreigners, and certainly against anything as strange and weird as a thing called Baha'i that nobody ever heard of in the first place, and they don't know whether it's some strange kind of a sect. And they don't ever try to overcome that initial prejudice and find out exactly what we do believe and what we stand for and so on. But in spite of all of that, the climate, spiritually and morally and physically, I would think, of the islands is enviable compared to most of the places that people live nowadays. We are being swallowed up all over the world, and that goes for developing countries too. We are being eaten alive by the economic forces, if you like, let loose in the world today. These giant companies that owned so many different things, including all the farms in America that produced the produce. Then the canning concerns and the packaging concerns that get it onto the shelves of the supermarkets. And then they own the chain of the supermarkets and so on. So that as I travel and see particularly our Western civilization, which, as you know, Shoghi Effendi said, in America had become the epitome of the Western civilization of Europe. In other words, its epitome is in the United States, and he called that a cancerous materialism. And the more I see of this end effect of Western culture, which is degenerated to the point of being such a terrifying civilization, the more I realize how important it is, if one can do it, to get away into the country, into the small places, out to the islands, abroad to the pioneer fields. Because it's better for you, and it's better, frankly, for your children, if you have any. Now, of course, all the Baha'is can't do that. I know that. Not everybody can rush away from the cities, because then who would hold the fort in the cities? Where would they get a job, for instance, that would be as good for them and their families and their future as working in a city? I'm not trying to suggest anything unreasonable. I'm just trying to state that the world is in a condition today that the further away you are from these intensive centers of Western civilization, the better off for you, and certainly the better off for your children. We are so fortunate to be Baha'is, and I think that we must recognize this fact. If every single moment of our lives we thanked Baha'u'llah for the privilege of having known that he existed and of his message, it would still be almost impossible to express the degree of gratitude that we owe him for having been privileged to accept him. And I think that is true of the people who were born into the Baha'i faith, like Violette in Persia, myself in Canada, many of the Baha'is here. And I think it is true of people who have just become Baha'is. Maybe we don't realize it clearly, but we have the blessing of having found the only secure thing in the whole world today, the only reasonable thing, the only plan that may work, the only scheme that is well balanced for a future society, because it comes from God. I used to tell the audiences in Africa, I said, you know, if you think about it, we're never going to be able to overcome our differences by our peers telling us what to do. In other words, India is not going to be told what to do by China. China is not going to be told what it should do by Russia. The United States is not going to be told what it should do by Russia. England is not going to accept to be told what it should do by Italy, and so on. Because we are peers. We are equal as human beings. We have, each of us, our own culture, our own nation, our own background. And there is no reason why my peer should tell me what I should do. He hasn't got sufficient authority to do so. He might advance an idea that part of it I liked and was willing to accept, but he can't tell me what to do because he is my equal, and I don't view him as being in a position of superior authority and intelligence to tell me where to get off. But if you have someone that comes from God, from the Creator, from on high, then you have a voice that speaks not only with total impartiality, but with total authority. And therefore it can tell humanity what to do. It can tell the religions to stop fighting and all come together under the umbrella, to use a very good modern term, of the faith of Baha'u'llah, which is the first time in history that we have had a faith which was aimed at a united planet, at least united in space, and rapidly becoming united in his economic outlook, his banking outlook, and eventually united in his political outlook. No one could ever give a message before that would apply to all these different backgrounds in the world, because they were too far away, different stages of development, no communications, and so on. But today the whole picture has changed. Therefore, if someone comes with divine authority to tell people what to do, that makes sense. Because they say, well, he's impartial. He's not Chinese, he's not Muslim, he's not Christian, he's not Western, he's not Eastern. In that sense, he is Supra. As Shoghi Effendi said, the Baha'i faith is not only supernatural, coming from God, power on high, but it is supranational. As I used to tell the friends, it's like the sky. Other things are international, but the sky is supranational because it covers all the nations in the world. And this is exactly like the teachings of Baha'u'llah. It's like the sky. Under it, it covers everything. And because of that, it is this answer to the problems of the world today. So how on earth could we Baha'is ever be sufficiently grateful for having heard that this faith exists? Be sufficiently grateful for the privilege of being able to serve it. Each one of us serves it in our own way. No one can force another Baha'i into some particular channel of service. You can lay a situation before the Baha'is, like the Universal House of Justice, saying we need so and so many pioneers in this phase of the plan, the British NSA, appealing to the membership in this part of the world and saying, well, look, we have this goal, we have that goal, we have so and so many this and so many that, and we need your help. But nobody can come to you and say, you've got to go and do this, or you've got to go and do that. No one can tell me what to do. I can volunteer. And I must obviously fit in, more or less specifically, with the workings of my local Baha'i community. Because without the administration, we can't exist and we can't function, especially as we are growing so fast. Couldn't coordinate anything without this very strong but very simple Baha'i administration. But still, I belong to me, and nobody can really tell me where to get off, you see. But within that framework, there is so much that each one of us can do for the faith of Baha'u'llah. I, of course, naturally at this age, I must have seen all kinds of things in all kinds of situations. But I see how people get sidetracked. They begin to attach importance to what is really not of primary importance. I always liken it to somebody who is driving in a car. You want to go from here to Glasgow. And there's a road that goes, but you come to a fork. And you say, well, that road looks also as if it was going to Glasgow, so I'll take that road. Instead of going this way, I'll go that way. And you get on the other road, but you find that in the end it never did go to Glasgow. It went somewhere totally different. And I think that this is what all of us have to be aware of in our lives. And young Baha'is have to be particularly aware of it. Don't get on the wrong turning. Now that you are Baha'is, now that you have either been born into the Baha'i faith or accepted the Baha'i faith, and you believe in it, don't let go of it. Don't let something else come and get so sidetracked that you'll never get to the destination that you have set yourself. You won't follow down that main road that takes you from this place in the end to that place. And I think that all of us, this is one of the arts, if you like, of growing up in life and being a Baha'i, and being a Baha'i till the end of your life, staying the course, in other words, is to learn to do things in a way that you don't get sidetracked. Now, other interests, yes. You go to university, you get a new job, you get married, you move to a new town. All kinds of factors come into shape lives. But the primary objective should not be lost sight of. And I think that this is particularly important for the youth, because that's a period of restlessness. And it's a period of experimentation, a period of search, so that very easily they can become sidetracked. Very easily they can suddenly say, well, I don't know, maybe I made a mistake. Maybe this is all nonsense. Maybe it'd be better to be a revolutionary. Maybe I should join this political party. What am I doing in something that doesn't believe in politics? When, look at those people, they're having strikes, they're having revolutions, they're doing it, they're active, in other words. And what am I doing, you see? And I think that all of these different factors enter into the lives, particularly of young people, and they have to analyze it very, very carefully and be conscious that such an attack on the foundations of their beliefs and spiritual life can take place and come upon them, so to speak, unawares. I was, as I say, born a Baha'i and always a Baha'i. And then I went to university as a partial. Never went as a full-fledged student because I never had any Orthodox education as a foundation for university work. And most of my personal friends were scientists, doctors and scientists. And those were the things that interested me at that time. And, of course, they all would pounce on me, you see. How do you know there's a God? What makes you think that one person is a manifestation of God and brings a message from on high? What makes you think that these teachings of Baha'u'llah are divinely inspired? What makes you think that man has a soul that survives after death and so on? And in those days, 50 years ago, it was so much harder. People of my generation in this room will remember, it was so much harder to defend your position, because they had a so much more materialistic concept of scientific fact. Whereas now, science has become almost attenuated. We know so much that, as one Baha'i said recently, she said, for the first time, we can talk about God in the laboratory. And that's true, because we're learning so much more that it's actually bringing the scientists closer to a belief that there is a power, a conscious power, a creative power behind the universe, and opening the door to tremendous spiritual concepts. But there wasn't in my days, and I can remember that for 1 week, I entirely lost my spiritual bearings. This attack on me through my mind shook me to my foundations, and I thought, well, maybe I'm wrong, you see. Maybe this is all nonsense. Maybe Baha'u'llah isn't from God. Maybe, maybe, maybe. And the only thing I could do was to pray. I couldn't discuss it with anybody. It was too deep. And I prayed an awful lot that week. And like a ship that goes through a very violent storm, I came out on the other side and went on sailing peacefully. And I never had another storm like that in my whole life. But that can come upon any of us. And, of course, that is the time that you must hang on to what you have found. You must hang on to the teachings of Baha'u'llah. If you're shaken in the spiritual aspect, then think of the material aspect. But hang on, and hang on tight, so that it is not taken from your hand, and you don't lose the most worthwhile thing in the world, which you were lucky enough to have in the beginning. I wanted to say something here, which I said in the youth conference at the beginning of this trip in England, and I'd like to repeat it here, because I notice there are quite a lot of Persian friends in this part of the world. And perhaps they weren't at that youth conference, but I want to warn the Persian young people to not associate with the other Muslim groups who are not Baha'is. Keep away from them. You didn't come to England or Scotland to study. You didn't come here as Baha'i refugees or whatever you are, because you wanted to be nationalistic towards a country that is murdering all your fellow Baha'is and annihilating them and uprooting them to the best of their ability after 100-something years. You came here really to live in a different and more liberal atmosphere, get away from religious fanaticism and persecution, and live amongst a people who are mumtaz, who are distinguished in their liberal ideas and their tolerance. Now, the worst thing that the young Baha'is can do, and I mean this very, very seriously, And it's exactly the same advice that my fellow Hands are giving, the Universal House of Justice giving. Keep away from any Muslim students or people in this part of the world. You cannot and should not try to teach them. If they want to become Baha'is, if there's something in their heart that is going to awaken, it will awaken without your help. They're anything but fools. And many Muslims, for instance, married to Baha'is in Iran and outside of Iran nowadays are becoming Baha'is. After what? Maybe 40, 50 years of marriage, because they say, this is the limit. What they've done now is too much. These Baha'is are not guilty. They are innocent. And we see this in our own relatives and in this whole situation in Persia, and they're accepting the faith and becoming very devoted Baha'is. But that's another category. In this country, make friends with the Scottish people. Make friends with your fellow students. Share in the activities of the Baha'i communities. Go on teaching trips. Attract other people to the teachings of Baha'u'llah. This is your privilege, and this is what will be of service not only to you, but to the Baha'i community in Great Britain. The National Assembly is very glad to have so many Persian Baha'is now in this part of the world to assist them in the teaching work. And in many ways, they are very staunch and wonderful Baha'is. They are Baha'is who for generations have withstood the tempest of persecution, you see. They're tried in the fire, and they can be of great help to the communities in which they are living, as I'm sure all of you know. But I'm addressing, as I say, my remarks to the Baha'i young people. And méfiez-vous, keep away from them. Devote yourselves to making friends with people of this country and attracting them to the faith and associating with them. And leave your own country to God, because frankly, nobody else can settle a hash of Persia but Almighty God. And he will do it. There's not any doubt about that. It says in the Quran, God prolongs the life of the evildoers so that they can increase their evil acts. It's in the Quran. I may not have quoted it exactly, but you can find it in Rodwell's translation of the Quran. And this is what God often does do. He allows people, you might say, of great evil, gives them enough rope to hang themselves, allows them to go on increasing their behavior to such a point that then the end comes. And whatever that end is going to be for Persia, I don't know, but frankly, I'd like to see it. You know, I have this very dear colleague, Mr. Furutan. We're both Hands, my fellow Hand in Haifa. We're both members of the International Teaching Center. And one night I was walking with Furutan, I don't know where, and I said, you know, Furutan, we're both getting old. It's time we left this world. No, he said, I don't want to leave it. I want to see something happen to Persia first. Well, I said, so do I, but you can see it from up there. No, 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 he said, I don't want to see it from up there. I want to see it from here. And I said, well, I'm with you there. I think I'd like to stay and see it from here, too, if it comes during my lifetime, because the treatment that this one country and its people and its leaders have given the Baha'is since 1844 is simply unbelievable. And consequently, their punishment is obviously going to be unbelievable. I remember so many times Shoghi Effendi said, to the pilgrims, he said, the Jewish people were responsible. Now, I know this doesn't work in with modern concepts, but forget them. Just take what the Guardian said. He said, the Jewish people were responsible for crucifying Jesus Christ for his death. And they were punished for 2,000 years until they were forgiven by God and returned to their homeland, which is all in the Old and the New Testament. And now the fact of the creation of the State of Israel. So he said, imagine what is going to be the punishment of the Muslims for persecuting two manifestations of God, for killing the Bab and for persecuting, exiling, and imprisoning Baha'u'llah for 40 years. Then one can try and visualize what the chastisement of God is going to be for a sin of this dimension. I think it's much easier to say this kind of thing in Scotland, where they still seem to believe in right and wrong, than it might be in other countries. Because, you see, people nowadays, perhaps they're getting away from it, but there was a period in our modern development, if you like, all over the world, where they believed in the teachings of psychology that you weren't really responsible for everything. Your mother smacked you, or somebody dropped you on your head, or they took the bottle away from you, or something unpleasant happened. Consequently, you developed this peculiarity. Consequently, you became a criminal, or maladjusted, or insecure, or God knows what, all these modern terms. Well, unfortunately, that bears very, very little relationship to anything taught by all the prophets of God. Because the prophets very clearly teach that there is right and there is wrong. There is what is permitted, there is what is not permitted, there is evil, there is good. And you have had it taught to you through the prophets of God, through, if you like, ministers in whatever church you came from, through the moralists in your society, whatever the source may be, it's all there. And if you choose to do the wrong thing, you are responsible for your own acts. In other words, there is still that concept of choice. You can make the choice to do what is right and do what is wrong. Now, I know that in different cultures, one thing may be right, in another culture it may be wrong. There are shades of right and wrong. There are degrees of sin, if you like to use the old-fashioned word, or whatever it is. But the fact remains that there are things that are permitted and there are things that are not permitted. There are things that you can do. There are things you must not do, and so on. And I think that Abdu'l-Bahá, and in the Baha'i writings, makes it quite clear that God does not require of a soul something that he does not give them the spiritual strength to do. Because if he did, he would be the essence of injustice. If God is going to require of me a series of choices in my life that I am unable to come to even an approximation of the right decision, he's most unfair. He's neither loving nor just if he does that to me. And in the teachings it says that God will not require of a soul something that he does not give it the strength to do, you see. And I think that that must apply to everybody. It applies in the sense of relativity to different situations and different categories. But the fundamental teaching is there. And I think that this is what we Baha'is have to understand more clearly. We don't take, what shall I say, we are not identified with the degenerating concepts of human behavior in the world today. We're as far from the permissive society as it is humanly possible to get. We don't condone or excuse misconduct. Naturally, we try to help people. We try to help our own children. We try to help our own behavior through prayer, through reading the writings, which are so nourishing to our souls, through listening to other people, whatever it is. But the fact remains that we have to be responsible, ultimately, for our own conduct and our own behavior. And I think that there again, we come to this choice of the roads in life. We have to be careful when we are making major decisions in life that we are making the right decision, that the decision is in the direction of the teachings, if you like, of Baha'u'llah, or in the direction which we hope to go in the service of Baha'u'llah, and not going to land us off in the other point of the compass because we took the wrong road. I remember Abdu'l-Bahá used to say that guidance was when the door opens. I'm sure many Baha'is remember those words. So often people say, well, how do I know whether I should do it or not? What is guidance? How do I know what is the right thing to do? And the Master said, of course, that if you wanted to do something, and the Guardian also used to emphasize this, you have to make an effort. Effort is required. Supposing I want to be a pioneer and go to Africa. Well, I have to make an effort. I have to think about it. I have to come to a decision. I have to want to go, and then I have to start to try to realize, you see, this objective that I have set myself. And I have to make a serious effort. But if the door constantly bangs on my nose, then I will know that this is not the will of God for me. Because guidance is when the door opens, not constantly closes. But the effort has to be there. The prayer, the desire, the longing, whatever it is. And then if still that door doesn't open, well, then you mustn't force it, because that is not the path for you. That is not the way that you should go. It, as I said, is such a privilege to be a Baha'i. And it is such a puzzlement, you might say, to all of us, that more people don't reach out for the faith. I'm sure that every one of us in this room, including Violette and I, who've been traveling since last, 14 months ago, over a year, through 23 countries, and of course meeting all kinds of people, officials and, people, whatever the circumstances may be, public meetings, social occasions, people that we met in contact with traveling or in our hotel or whatever it is. And in a way that has at least some degree of tact, we hope, we try to let them know that we are Baha'is. We try to say something that may make them say, well, why are you traveling? Well, what is it you do believe? Well, what are you talking about in your talks? And so on. And to see what kind of a remark might attract that particular person to ask more questions, to want to have a Baha'i pamphlet, to want to, for instance, have a Baha'i address, to want to know a Baha'i in that city. And the response is almost zero. It's very extraordinary. It doesn't seem to matter what you do or say, or how much you pray, because I'm sure all of us pray a great deal when we come in contact with other people, that the person will just reach out, that we will be guided to say the right thing. We won't say the wrong thing. Won't rebuff somebody, but will attract them. And the response is almost zero. So that it shows how really sick mankind is. You remember Baha'u'llah said that the divine physician had come into the world with a remedy, and the patient was dying, but no one would let the doctor get next to the patient. And this seems to be the whole history of the teachings of Baha'u'llah during his lifetime, Abdu'l-Bahá, Shoghi Effendi, the House of Justice now, and all of us, that still the patient is getting sicker and sicker and sicker by the minute, and still either he cannot, or we for some reason or other are not able to deliver the divine medicine to the patient that is dying of his ailment. So perhaps he just has to die. Maybe that's what we have to resign ourselves to, that, well, let me mind my business and see that I don't die spiritually and wither on the bough, so to speak, but that I get to first base spiritually, because that is something that is in my own hands. We can't live other people's lives. We can't be responsible for the decisions of other people. Nobody knows it better than parents. I think that parents and perhaps even more so mothers would often literally die for their child. They would die for the child. The love is so strong that if they could do something to save the child's suffering in life, to save it some terrible mistake, some terrible illness, something or other, a terrible bad marriage, a bad direction, whatever it is, they would really offer their life in the place of the child. But it doesn't do any good. You can't live anybody else's life for them.